Susan Stamberg was the first woman to anchor a national nightly news broadcast in the United States. She has been on staff at NPR since the network began in 1971. She currently serves as a special correspondent. This talk with KUOW's Marcy Silman covers the early days of NPR, Stamberg's creation of Weekend Edition, which included her promotion of Click and Clack and Will Shorts, and her passion for arts and culture reporting. Their conversation took place in the KUOW Performance Studio on July 25th. Thank you to Robert Jacobs Springer for our recording.
Susan, in addition to all those things that Karen introduced you, she was a great inspiration for me, and I've been listening to you, you know, maybe not, well, yeah, probably all 45 years that you've been working.
Good
but,
heavens.
I wanted, before we talk about art specifically, for you to go into the Wayback Machine and take us back to those early years at NPR, because Big Mama Founding Mother, you were there, present at the creation.
I was, indeed. But before any of that, I'm so glad to be with you.
And I
am a great admirer of Marcy's work over many, many years. And, you know, there are not so many of us who really hold the flame for the arts, especially on the radio. But you have been so stalwart and so talented about it for all these days.
I'm like a homing pigeon. Karen was saying I came back. I can't stay away.
Yeah,
so
obviously.
Thank you.
And it shows in your work.
Thank
it
you.
It shows in your work. So what do you want to know, early days?
Yeah. Early days.
They were thrilling and terrifying at the same time. There were, we had a staff of something like 68 and 68 or so member stations. So today we're over 800, aren't we, Karen? And staff's bigger too. So we began with absolutely no resources. We had five reporters. Today they're well over 100, even more, probably 200. By now, and we're all over the world. But in the very beginning, truly in the beginning, before furniture had been delivered, we were gathered in rooms by really the man who created All Things Considered, our first program manager. His name was Bill Seemering. And we sat on the floor because there were no chairs. All there was a great big reel-to-reel tape recorder. And we were asked to bring in samples of our own work that we could play for one another to try to figure out what we wanted this new thing, this new creation, this new nightly news program that we were about to launch, what we wanted it to sound like. So people did that, and, you know, they were sort of okay, and some were terrific, and this and that. And then came my turn, and with great hesitancy, I put on a tape that I of a series that I was producing at Karen's old station, WAMU, in Washington, which was also began in this tiny, tiny way, the way NPR did, and has grown to be one of the major institutions in the country. But anyway, it had been a program of mine there. It was called A Federal Case, and it began, I got the lowest voice person I could find. We were on the campus of American University, so I went around listening to the kids, and when I heard the right voice, I said, come here. And I brought him into the station, and I got them to read copy for me. And that the announcer's voice was, from WAMU in Washington, this is a federal case. And Bill stopped us right there, Seemering, and he said, that is exactly how we do not want to sing. And that was my first lesson, not just from this genius, which he is and certainly was then, but just about how to be open and how to rethink something that I had been doing at that point for a number of years. And what he said when he ultimately, and he was the one who hired me, but also he was the one who chose me from the staff to be the first woman to anchor a national nightly network news broadcast. And he was the one who said right from the beginning, we don't want to sound like that voice from the top of the mountain. Mm-hmm. We want to sound conversational, as if we're just talking across a fence to a neighbor. And that really, it was his ear that launched that sound. And he said it to me too when I started, and I was still, because there were no role models. You know, I was the first one to do this, so I imitated the men. I talked as deeply as I could, and I wanted to be Walter Cronkite. Mm-hmm. And he said to me these golden words, be yourself. It was like Fred Rogers. Remember how he used to say that to the children? I like you just the way you are. Really? But it gave the voice that we now know as public radio, because we all talk that way.
We all talk that way, and almost now it's a cliche. It's the butt of jokes.
I know, they make fun of us.
Yes,
especially on Saturday Night Live.
Yes, but it's okay. But you were still, 45 years ago, a woman in what was still a man's world.
Absolutely.
Now we see a lot of women anchoring, where we hear them maybe more than we see them.
Uh-huh.
I wondered what kind of pushback, if any, you got from people you were trying to interview, perhaps?
It wasn't so much the interviewees, although in those days, because we were so new, no one had ever heard of us, so you'd have to do this minute and a half song and dance. Hello, it's Susan Stamberg. I'm calling from National Public Radio. It's a brand new radio network, non-commercial, interconnected. We have 68 stations, and we do a nightly news broadcast. It's called All Things, you know, and on, till you explain. You had to do a lot of tapping. Now you don't. You just say, hello, I'm calling from NPR, and they can't wait to get on the air. So it wasn't that so much, but it was among the stations and the managers of the stations.
Really?
Yes. Who apparently called in and got in touch very early and said, you can't have a woman as an anchor here. A woman's voice will not be authoritative, and people will not take her seriously. You can't have a woman doing news. These calls all went to Bill Siemering, that creator of All Things Considered, and this is an example of his leadership. He waited 11 years to tell me this. Because, well, first of all, he probably forgot after a while. But in the beginning, he just knew that it would affect me. You know, it would affect whatever it was that I was doing then. And he had great confidence in me and what I was doing. And he felt if he just let it go and let people get used to the sound of a woman doing this, that it would turn out okay. Now, granted, there was a little truth to it, because in those days, those were the days before satellites. So the sound was different. It was on landline, the kind of telephone lines that if you own any telephones that are connected to things, you know. The quality is, for me, a whole lot better than my iPhone. But nonetheless, going across the country, it wasn't the best sound. And what it did was diminish the bass and peak the treble. So it probably made me, and we women, sound a little squeakier than in fact we are in life. But that was about it. And bless Bill, you know, he never told me this, and he just let me continue. And not over a long time, but gradually, the criticism went away and more listeners began joining. But that's how it was, because it was so unusual.
We are decades from that time when there were 68 people and
yes,
five reporters and 68 stations. At this point in time, people expect if there's an event, they're going to find NPR reporters there.
Definitely.
At the very least. I'm curious how what you covered 45 years ago and how it was different from what we might hear today if we flick on NPR.
Well, I anchored the first election night for NPR. Mm-hmm. I'm not a big politico, much like Marcy. My heart is in the arts, and I always held back. The thing that got me through the worst news days was the fact that I knew I'd get to talk to John Irving or some great creative person at some point in the day, and I knew that would get me through Watergate. But because I was the one on the air, they had me anchor election, and here's what that was like. I sit in Washington. I had radio pals, you know, one other reporter, I think, and some experts, a guy named Godfrey Sperling, who worked for the Christian Science Monitor, who, because it was a long broadcast night, it went on till around 1 a.m., and close to 11:30, I looked over to him, and he was asleep. It was very rocky, but we had stations around the country, and we were going around the country to hear what the returns were, but here's how we did it. Again, no satellites. I would say, hi, Ames, Iowa, 2, 3, 4, and the control, ours, would have to flip a switch. Ames would have to flip a switch, so there was a delay. It must have been 3 seconds. Ames would say, hi, Washington, here in Ames, we're finding so-and-so, and the vote is this and this, and turnout. Over to you, Susan. 2, 3, 4. That's how it was. It really sounds a long time ago, doesn't it?
Well, but it wasn't really all that long ago. I was explaining to somebody that how we used to send our stories to NPR.
Yeah.
Now we now actually we don't even push a button. Now we just drag the story over in the, I don't remember what the name of the server is now.
Yeah.
Somebody, it has a name.
Yeah.
But we used to, we had a chief engineer where we uplinked it. We would bring our tape. Do you all know what tape? It used to be this plastic stuff. And we would put it on a machine and there were things that you had to dial.
Right.
And then somebody in Washington at the other end would have to
record
it onto tape again. So it's been quite a change, but also a change in, the ability to cover breaking news.
Yes.
I mean, there are good trade-offs and bad trade-offs, but...
Yeah, but absolutely. But as a matter of fact, the ability, sound has always been there first. And when Kennedy was assassinated at CBS, Dan Rather was in Dallas and phoned the news in to New York. And Cronkite, he was told this was happening, we have to go on the air instantly. And they couldn't get going fast enough for television. It was such a cumbersome medium. He walked into an announce booth, and so the first place he broadcast was via radio because it was so fast, and it still is. And I can remember having to go, you know, if you were out in the field doing a story and you needed to file it, you walked up to, I mean, there were no iPhones either. You needed a landline, and you'd walk up to the farmer's house, knock on the door, and say, "Could I please use your telephone?" Gee, things are better, aren't they?
It's a lot
they
easier.
They are better.
Someday we'll bring in Martin Costi, who lives in Seattle and is an NPR correspondent. He brought his backpack in with, I mean, he carries a transmitter around, so he can just set it up. It's different. So you were a co-host of All Things mm-hmm. Considered for almost two decades, right?
Yeah, 14 years.
14
and then
years.
I went and put the Sunday morning program on the air, Weekend Edition Sunday. And I did that for another 3+, and then became a correspondent.
How was it different to go from every night at 5, because it did start at 5, to the Sunday morning show? What was different for you?
Well, it wasn't every day, you know. Although it took me such a long time, Marcy, to unwind from that. I mean, there were months after I left ATC when 5 seconds before 5 then would come and I would clear my throat and get ready to broadcast. It just became such an endemic habit. And also, you just get wound up so tightly when you're doing that kind of news. And not as much breaking news then, but still relentless news every day. So it was wonderful just to not have to crash like that. And
so there was the pace that was slower. How much input did you have in shaping Weekend Edition Sunday and making it what it is?
Almost total. And
it was your show.
It was. And it's really why I was interested in doing it. I wasn't crazy about going from 5 days a week to working Sundays. I had a young child and my husband, and I didn't like giving up weekends. So when they asked me if I would do it, I was quite reluctant. And the deal we struck was we could pre-record, because it was very clear, and the stations agreed, that it was not to be a news broadcast. That's not what people wanted on Sunday. They wanted something easier and looser and more relaxed. So we could record. We recorded on Fridays. And so just the tapes, they were tapes, would be broadcast on Sunday mornings. But then news really started. News didn't happen on weekends. I mean, that's another way that things, either that or nobody was around to let us know, you know. But once that began to happen, and there were big stories that broke on Saturdays and Sundays, in Washington, and producer for Scott and Rachel Martin, the weekend shows, said to me, "I'm so wiped out. We've had 3 weekends of breaking news." When you just have to tear up everything you've got, because most of those shows are pre-recorded, tear it all up and just go live. It's really hard to do that, no matter how big your staff is. And he was just exhausted, as was the whole staff. But in those days, it really wasn't happening so much. I think the world was moving more slowly. 1987, we went on.
1987.
Sunday, yeah.
Weekend Edition Sunday.
Yeah.
You also told me the other day that it was a chance not just to pre-record and spend more time on the weekend with your family, but to do the kinds of content that you had, that your heart was with.
Yes, absolutely. It was that because there was a lot of conversation with stations as to what it was that they wanted for this Sunday program. And the way I translated their wishes, and they certainly meshed with mine, it's what I wanted to do at that time, was to make it like the radio version of the arts and leisure section of the New York Times, so that you would spend some time talking about various stories in the arts. And I asked myself, because I had a lot to do with designing that show, what do you like to do on Sundays? And one answer was, go for a ride in a car. And so at that time, we asked stations to send in good local things that they were doing that might work well on this new program. And the Boston station sent in an air check from two guys who'd been doing a program for them local. This is really a good story. I'm going to tell you the whole story. Doing a program for them for 10 years, which is what you need to do before you launch a broadcast. You need to practice someplace local and then go on national, because you're going to get a lot of opinions. Nonetheless, they sent this. And this cassette made the rounds. The news director, who was then Robert Siegel, listened to it and said, oh, no, I mean, this won't have any place in national. No. My producer listened and said, when lobsters fly. My husband listened, and he said, I don't think so, Susan. It doesn't sound as if it would fit with your concept for what this program. We're going to have a live pianist. We had a pianist on that program who just sat in the studio with me and played. He did all the little buttons, the little interstitials, and played a good 3-minute solo, too, as well, jazz player. No, it won't fit, said my husband with her. And I, there are many versions of this story, you have to understand, but I like my version of the best. I said, these guys are great. Everybody loves cars. That accent is so incredible. Even if you don't care about cars, they're just so funny and good. So, car guys, there they were. And then the other thing I decided I liked to do on Sunday was crossword puzzles. Mm-hmm. So I called a friend who was doing a puzzle for the Atlantic magazine. And I asked him if he would come on, and he said, no, I'm too busy, I can't. But there's this guy, he edits a magazine called, I think it was called Puzzles. Why don't you get in touch with him? And I did. So Will Shorts came on that program, yeah. And I think it's what helped him get his job in the New York Times. I do, because it gave him such an audibility, you know, that they tapped him. So those two stalwarts, when I left, the car guys got their own show. Then the network decided to move them away from this 5-minute thing and, you know, give them their own program, which was a pretty good decision. But that's how flexible it was, and how you could just bring your own, you know, do it from your heart, which is what I've always done that in broadcasting. But to have 2 hours to do it every week was good.
So how many years did you do that?
I did it a little more than 3.
And then you said, I have had enough?
Well, then there was more and more pressure as the world changed to make it a news program. And, you know, I'd done that for 14-plus years, and I wasn't so interested. I was having such a good time with this cultural thing that I thought, no, that's what I want to do. And so I asked.
And you said, I just want to do this. I want to cover arts
let
and
me
culture.
Let me be your correspondent. Let me go ahead and do that. And they've always, you know, those network people, they've really been very, very kind to me. Those suits, they've let me do it.
What's the biggest difference between, besides the time commitment, between hosting and being a correspondent?
You know, Marcy, I had to learn. I should have called you. I had to learn how to be a reporter. I had no idea.
You hadn't done that?
No. The hosts interviewed, you know. That's what you did. You did interviews. You didn't have to assemble a range of opinion or put them in some sort of order. So I went around to all my reporting pals and said, well, okay, how do I do this? What do you do? And Neil Conan was the most helpful. He said, you need as many pieces of tape as you'll have minutes on the air. So for a 5-minute story, you need 5 tape clips. That was really helpful. I mean, that's how rudimentary it was and how basic and how ignorant I was. And it didn't come to me right away. It really took some time to find my own voice as a reporter. At first, I, again, was imitating everybody else because now I had role models. You know, we'd been on the air for a while. So I listened hard, for instance, to Scott, who made a tremendous difference to me. He, too, started as a reporter. And he would include in his reports pieces of tape like this. test, 1, 2, test, from wherever he was. Tape, things you wouldn't expect to hear on the radio, he would record as ambient sound. And because it was so unusual to hear, it got your ear. It got you listening. So sort of devices and tricks like that, and funny tapes and people stumbling and odd things. I'll give you an example for a structure of a story. I was going to talk to a wonderful novelist named André Debussy. Do you know him? Mm-hmm. His son now, the second, I think he is, yes. Is André, one, died several years ago, but the son is also a wonderful writer, and he continues the family tradition. André Debussy was a terrific fiction writer who had a terrible thing happen to him. He stopped his car on the side of a road in upstate Massachusetts, I guess it was, because he saw a car ahead and somebody trying to fix a tire, a flat tire. And an oncoming car went into him. And one leg of his had to be amputated. And the other, he had no strength, nothing. And I wanted to go and see him. And I went up to Haverhill, Massachusetts, to do a story with him. And we spent the day. He was taking therapeutic horseback rides. That was part of his therapy. And I went there, you know, recorded the horse's hooves, all of that. But he had a special device on the top of his car, which allowed him, a chain device, to lift himself in his wheelchair into the car and go over to the wheel. And I recorded, you know, when you're on the road that way, you record every sound that's not the sound of a human voice, as well as the interviews. So you have a palette of sound to deal with. That's how I started the story, was with that peculiar sound of just a chain being hoisted, because I knew it would grab the listener's ear. They would say, huh, what is that? And then stick around and listen at least long enough to find out.
Do you travel with a producer when you are
on the road? Oh, in the golden days I did, but of late, no. Always as a host I did, and even as a starting correspondent I did. But those days are long gone, unfortunately. We used to travel with producers and engineers, people who knew what they were doing with microphones. I do not. I have tried to record oceans by standing on the edge of one, holding a microphone. Now, you know, you can't do that. You need really good equipment and a proper and headsets and all of it. But the engineers knew. Unfortunately, various budget considerations and the booming of our need to go online and do so much more on the website, which meant hiring hundreds more people simply to focus on that rather than sound, has deprived us of that thing we invented, which is this form of radio that you've heard for so many years.
We really have heard it for so many years. I think people take it for granted.
It's always sounded like that, but it has not.
The way we do radio, which is its own wonderful joy, which we could probably spend 2 hours just talking about why we love radio, but we won't do that. I was curious how you decide who you want to cover or what you want to cover.
Well, I am so lucky that they really let me do that. But I'm fairly productive, so there's always something that interests me, and it's why I do this work. And so something will always capture my imagination or my attention. I don't have a travel budget now, and so I'm pretty much bound, unless I'm going somewhere to make a speech. For instance, coming here, I didn't set up a story to do for myself this time. KUOW kindly brought me out. And so on somebody else's travel dime, often I'll stay an extra day and set up a story and do it. So it gets me out of Washington, or when I go on vacation, sometimes if it's in Paris, I like working there. Mm-hmm. And so on my own dime, I get there, but I, you know, spend some days doing it just because I love the work. But otherwise, and in general, it's something that sparks my interest. It may sound egotistical, but I figure if I'm interested in it, somebody else, you know, there'll be other people who are. And if they're not, my job is to grab their ears and get them to be interested. So that's sort of it. And it'll be things I don't know about. That's what always drives me.
Arts and culture, I mean, it's exponentially large.
Yes.
It just keeps getting bigger and bigger. I know, because you told me this the other day, that you have a particular interest in visual arts, or at least those are the stories that I have heard most of from you lately.
Yes, that's what I've been doing for quite a while. Out of love, And I'll tell you something. I didn't tell you this the other day, but it might interest you. I also felt we've got the usual turf wars at National Public Radio, at any place will. And I knew nobody else would want to do this. You know, I wouldn't be stepping on Totenberg's toes to try to go talk to the Supreme Court. And I wouldn't be stepping on this one and that one. This was a passion of mine. And so I could go out and do it and be free, too. That had a lot to do with it. Also because I was the kid sitting in the kitchen at the kitchen table with the radio on and the paint box in front of me and doing watercolors while I listened to the great old radio soap operas. And so always I've had that artistic interest. I went to a high school in Manhattan that specialized in music and art. And so it was always a driving force for me. And as I said, it was the carrot on my heavy news days that got me through those days, because I knew that the love of my life was going to be there, apart from my husband, was going to be there in the course of the day. So it was pretty natural, and I naturally go to museums anyway, regularly. And as I told my son, I really raised my son this way. I said, find something you love to do, and then figure out a way to get paid to do it. And he's an actor, and he got it half right for many years. But now he's okay. He's doing just fine. But that's so, and also to do visual art on the radio is I do because it's so impossible. You know, it's such an impossible thing to do that I like that challenge.
That's always this thing I get pushed back. How are you going to do this?
I know. Well, and you do so much in dance. How do you do it when they can't see it?
Well, that's the joy of the web, isn't it?
Now? Isn't it? Isn't it?
There's a whole lot of reasons that we would cover art. Most of them are because it pleases me. But I think these days, especially last week, I was laughing because I did this tiny story about this young boy who is studying ballet. And for some reason, that story, which was 2 minutes and 1 second long, it's like been shared and sent around. And wow. I think it has to do not so much with the story, or maybe it was a good story, but the time in which people heard that story, or why people... Maybe people needed rest. I wanted you to talk about the role, I guess,
yes,
of what we do in the framework of heavy news.
Yeah. They did that with your story because they needed to hear that then.
Mm-hmm.
I really think so.
I think so.
There's some therapeutic piece to art, I believe. It's not like going to the shrink. I don't mean it that way. It's that it takes you someplace else. It takes you away from the now and the nitty-gritty and, all the stuff in this world, which we live with now, partly because of these communication explosions. And so we're exposed to so much more. But also, it becomes a way to help us deal with those things, with the difficulties, more effectively. After 9/11, I went to one of the first things I did, really for myself, was go to my favorite gallery in Washington, the Phillips Gallery. I don't know if any of you have been there, but if not, next time you're in D.C., go, because it's fabulous. It's just sensational museum. And I just went there. Yes, I took my tape recorder with me, but I didn't use it. I just went to absorb the beauty of the place and what was on the walls and what artists from other times had done. And then I went back and just wrote an essay about the difference that standing in the middle of something eternal, which that art is, the art in that museum, not all of it is, but much of it is, the difference that it made to me to be able to go back then with a clearer mind, so that then I could face all the aftermath and the residue of 9/11 a little more clearly, and not just be burdened with it, not be just so pulled down with it. And I tend to do that quite a bit. And I not just for me, but also I think listeners really need that. I think we all do. There's a huge role that the arts play, and it's why they last. So, we had a winter some years ago. It was the Newt Gingrich Congress, 104th Congress, when government kept shutting down. He kept shutting down the government, and that closed the door on the National Gallery of Art at a time when they were doing an extraordinary Vermeer exhibition. And I went and talked to people, and people didn't care. They stood online in the snow around the block to get into these doors that were locked. The Dutch, who were lending most of their penny, couldn't believe it, I was told. The embassy reached out to the gallery and said, "What are you talking about? Your government can shut down the museum and its people can't get in to see these paintings from our country?" They never heard of such a thing. But the people stood waiting for it. And I wrote about that, too. I also interviewed some of those people online. "What are you doing here? Don't you know it's closed?" And how shocked they were. And I wrote about how those Vermeers, you know, no one remembers who the king or the president or their parliament, whatever form they had in the 1600s when he made those paintings. No one remembers the political problems or the issues of the day. But this many years later, there we stand in the snow online around a corner to see what he was making then. That's what art will do. And that's why I love paying attention to it.
This is where we stand on the table like the movie Norma Rae and say art matters. I sometimes feel like I want to do that. I told Susan the other day that it's what separates us as primates from we're not from the dogs. I love dogs and cats and animals, but we make art.
Yes.
And I know elephants have painted, but I don't count that.
That doesn't count.
It's the same kind of self-expression. What kinds of challenges have you faced in doing this kind of reporting, or haven't you?
I don't think so. No, the main one I have is because it's because of what's happening in media these days and some of the extraordinary things that we could not have predicted 45 years ago when we went on the air, certainly, but even maybe 10 years ago. The fact that newspapers have collapsed or shrunken to such an extent that my morning New York Times, especially the Sunday Times, which used to be like this, looks anorexic. I can pick it up now with my pinky because it's, you know, there's nothing left to it. And because television, which in the old days when you had the three main channels and the country stopped and sat down and looked at them, that exists. Nobody's doing serious news on television anymore. So we have become the major source for more and more people for serious news broadcasting. And as a result, what that does to our two-hour slots in the morning and afternoon news magazines makes it harder sometimes to get work like ours on the air. So I have at home now one story sitting waiting for broadcast, and it's been waiting for about a week with the conventions and other news that's been breaking. The Munich shooting, all of it. You know, there's just so much we feel obligated now to get on the air, to send people out to follow and come back and report, that it will put some of the arts stories on hold for a while. They're mostly not date-pegged, and so that's all right. They will last, as the art does, one hopes, for several days. But I'll go back and I'll have two more that I'll turn around fairly quickly, which will also, I'm sure, I just expect this now. I can't say this has to run next Thursday.
It is true, I have to say, just as somebody who files for NPR,
yes,
that you always try to find some indelible time peg and
right,
say, this must run.
Right.
It doesn't matter.
Right.
Is it still happening a month later?
Right.
Sure.
Right.
Sure, it's good
right,
to go. Just run it. And usually I'm happy if it gets on the air, but there are those fights.
Yeah.
Do you ever miss things like being on the road? For example, you said you didn't love politics, but do you ever miss that idea of...
Never. Never.
Enough said about that. You have, I can't remember, you told me a number of how many people you'd interviewed, and maybe you made that number up. But
I do.
Okay, so out of the 10 million people that
you've
talked to...
There you go, it's close to that.
I mean, there's so many, people ask me this stupid question too, I'm just going to ask you, it's like, who sticks out in your head?
Oh,
not who's
well,
your favorite, but who sticks out as a really memorable interviewee, something that was, you know, when you have the meeting of the minds and you're both kind of vibrating when it's over?
Well, I spoke about this a little bit the other day. Leon Fleischer, do you know that name? He is a great classical pianist, and he was certainly the top pianist of his generation. And such a human being. His heart is 12 times bigger than any of ours. A great humanitarian and a great humanist. And he had, I had interviewed him from time to time over the years about various musical matters, but then a terrible thing happened to him. He lost the use of his left hand. It was, then I don't think they had the word for carpal tunnel syndrome, but it's probably what it was, because I've gone to see him perform, and he really attacked the piano. You know, you could just see him playing fast and furiously. And so he lost the use of that. And what he did was, he went for various therapies. He asked questions about surgery. There were no satisfying answers. And so he played his way through the repertoire for the right hand. And when he finished with them, he began commissioning music for the right hand alone. And we talked about that. We talked about it. And what difference that made to him and how he could keep persisting. And he said, this is my life. What else would I do? I've spent my life working on this ability and working on this passion. And I can't just put it aside now because this thing has happened to me. I have to continue to do this thing that means so much and find different ways to do it. And so he persisted. And eventually he did get different therapies, and he had a lot of surgeries. And ultimately something worked, and he could begin to use that hand again. And so I called him again about it, because very tentatively he began performing in public with both hands. And he said it was a terrifying experience every time, because he was never sure that he would be able to count on the use of both the hands. And then what was he going to do? But he persisted. And when the time comes, this is another story about the power of art. It was after 9/11. I was listening to the radio at home one morning, having my breakfast before going to work, and it was maybe the day after 9/11, and listening to the radio, and it was just one dreary, terrible story after another. You can remember those days. But I noticed that in between one story and another, there were these little musical smudges. We call them buttons, but they're, you know, pieces of music, brief ones that separate one story from the other. And I noticed my own reaction as a listener to how different I felt when those little musical interludes came on. And on the way to work, I thought, what can I do, you know, for our broadcasts right now? But at that point, I was on the staff of Morning Edition. I still am. What can I do that will make a difference or help? I'm an interviewer. There were loads of interviews going on. I didn't think that was any contribution I could make. I'm a reporter, but I wasn't in New York, and we had plenty of reporters out in the field, too. But what I remembered was that music and the difference it made to me. And so I got to work and went to see the producer and asked if I could have a minute or two on every broadcast for the next week or so, in which all we did was play music. And to their credit, I mean, this is a news broadcast in the middle of a crucial story where news was breaking rather relentlessly. They said yes. And so I called the major musicians of the country and did little brief interviews with them, just what would you like America to be listening to right now? And the first call was to Leon Fleischer. And here's what he said. Ode to Joy. Isn't that extraordinary? I mean, in the middle of all of that, a hymn to humanity and to humanism, to play that. And then we went on. Beverly Sills wanted somebody to sing an aria from Norma, and Judy Collins wanted to sing Amazing Grace, and just each one, Quincy Jones wanted to hear Debussy. It was really wonderful, and listeners loved it, and columnists began to write about this because it was such an unusual thing, and it really made a difference. And then it saw its time. We did it for about a week and a half and then moved along.
So the public loved it. What kind of feedback did you get from your colleagues, from fellow reporters and correspondents?
Well, I think at first I thought it was nuts. And because it was. I mean, it was such an outrageous thing to do for us, in our terms, on a news broadcast, especially in the middle of that kind of news. You know, the impulse for any reporter is let me get on the air and find out what's happening, and then tell people. But they got it pretty fast. They did. And the stations did, too. So there was not much many complaints.
I always tell people the parts of the shows that I remember are the art stories.
Me too.
Yeah. And now you know why. That's why I do what
That's
I do.
That's why.
We wanted to open this up for you to ask Susan questions. And again, there is Shalane, and she has a microphone. And because we're recording this, raise your hand and Shalane will run to you or walk to you, graciously proceed to you. So, questions?
Don't be shy.
Don't be shy.
I got the Christian Science Monitor for 30 years, but it kept getting thinner and thinner, and I didn't want to go online. And I used to always like the fact that you used Christian Science Monitor reporters because they had excellent snippets from all over the world wherever you were interviewing them. So I'm wondering if they're still on because I haven't heard them very much. And I have one other question. I'm wondering if you ever do any arts program on all the art quilters that are in the United States, and have you interviewed any of them?
All the what?
Quilters.
The quilters.
Yeah.
Sure I have. But let me speak. Thanks. I'm glad you asked about the monitor. When we started, we had five reporters, and we had a special arrangement with the Christian Science Monitor, which was a major newspaper in its day, and had reporters everywhere, all over the world. So they were our first reporting staff. I would call them wherever news was breaking, wherever in the globe, because they were everywhere, and interview that reporter on the scene. And we did that for years. I mean, it was a fabulous resource until around, let's see, we went on the air in 72, till around 1980. Well, I better be careful with dates here. I'm not exactly sure, but maybe early 80s, when we got our first foreign correspondent. That was Robert Siegel, and he opened our bureau in London. So until that time, we were really dependent, and it was a wonderful resource for us.
It's also that they started their own radio service.
Yeah, that was
right. Monitor
right.
Radio.
But not then. That came later. They did it later.
So the world is Christian Science Monitor reporters.
Yeah.
Were the basis of the show The World that we ran.
Yeah.
We
is still it still
run.
On? It's still on. I don't know if you have it here still.
I think we
but
do.
But we hear it in the I call it the other, the wrong Washington, where I live, D.C. This is the right, or proper, it's not so proper here either, is it? But about quilters, yes. What was that wonderful show, Bees?
Bees.
Yeah, what was it? Bees something.
The G's Bend Quilt.
Did that come here?
Yes, I did. I did an interview with them when they came
Weren't
here.
Weren't they incredible
yeah, they
to
were
talk
incredible.
To?
Yes.
And the work that they do
yeah,
is so
it was
fabulous.
Amazing.
So I remember doing that one, but I'm sure I've done others over the years, and knitting and sewing and embroidery, all of that, all the hand arts.
Catherine had a question.
Yeah, so I'm wondering, I'm wondering, as the world changes and we boomers are kind of booming out, and young people, you know, are growing up, what you see in terms of the future and the challenges sort of adjusting to the change but hanging on to your core values as a network?
Well, that's something that every station and certainly the network is wrestling with every single day, because how do we hold on to our graying audience and how do we bring the young ones in? And the whole push is to get those young ones in. So the answer is you can't just do it in radio anymore. Now, they have this wonderful word, platforms. You have to do it on. I used to think that was shoes. Well, it was. Anybody remember platform heels? But now it's all those other things, those smartphones and the various listening devices and podcasts, et cetera, et cetera. So in terms of sound and audio, I'm the owner of 8 radios in my home. Mm-hmm. Oh, no, 7. 1, the 8th is in the car. But I still have physical radios that, do you too?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
That I turn on. So, yet we do focus groups with 20-somethings and say, show of hands, who here owns a radio? And not one hand goes up. They don't even think about the radio in their car because they're not listening to that. They're listening on their devices to podcasts, etc. So I think the life of radio may be a short one, but the life of sound is eternal, much like the Vermeers. You know, it goes back to the time of the caveman when they'd come in after the kill and stand around and tell each other stories. So the sound of the human voice telling you what happened today and telling you a story that you've never heard before will never go. It will never evaporate. But the ways in which it gets presented now and delivered, that's changing all the time. And there's a tremendous scramble amongst organizations like ours to, I hate this word, but I'll use it anyway, monetize those sound elements as well as all the things that we're trying to do online now, and to bring the young people in to the fold as well, turn them, get them to turn on their radios, or if they're not, anyway, to download sound from the things that we're doing online. But it's very much in flux right now. It's really, for many, that's an extremely exciting time. I don't find it so much because I'm old.
Well, it's a challenge. You heard Karen, when she was introducing this event, talk about the things that we have. We have a really dynamic website with the staff that we have, which I think is going to increase. Yes, yes, she says, thanks to you guys. And we're increasingly on social media now. We just started our own podcast pilot. So it's tough because there aren't ways. It isn't like you take out an ad or there's an underwriter anymore. It doesn't work that same way. So we'll figure it out. Yeah, sure.
So there's these different platforms, but what does it do to your content? Because, you know, you used to have a two-hour show, and now it's these little snippets. And
yeah, but the two-hour show always consists of shorter elements, and they can get pulled out of the 2 hours and put into these other forms. We're having more and more push now at NPR, I don't know if you all are, to do shorter pieces.
Yes.
Are you?
Yes.
I used to be very lucky to get 7 minutes sometimes. Well, on my ATC days, I did full half-hour documentaries. Those days are gone, by and large.
But they're coming back on podcasts.
But
that's the circle
the
back.
Thing.
Podcasts can be any length. Online can be any length. So that's, I think, where you'll see that material, at least from KUOW, on the air. There's all the studies of how long people listen, and I don't have the data, so I'm not going to say what it is.
It would only depress you. but here's what I don't know. This, to me, is a conundrum. They say the young, well, all of our attention spans, mine certainly has, have shrunk. And they say the young people don't have the time. You know, they'll spend 30 seconds on something, and then they move on. And yet they have the time to sit down with these podcasts, something like The Serial, which was the number one hit of the thing, something we're doing now called Invisibilia, which is another long form. They go to TED Talks, which take a good long time. Isn't that interesting? But I think it is, they're doing it on, it's about my control and what I want. So they can do it on their own time, and they can time shift that way when they have the time to listen. So that's all to the good, I think.
So long stories will be there, just in different places.
Different
maybe.
Places.
Yeah.
Wanted to ask whether you could talk a little bit about the origin of the recitation of the Declaration of Independence on the 4th of July, as well as, number two, is there going to be a sequel at some point for Mama Stanberg's cranberry recipe?
The sequel will be the end of Thanksgiving. When Thanksgiving disappears, that's when Mama Stanberg's cry. Every year it's a tougher fight to get it on the air, figure out a new way, but I'm determined. For as long as I'm around, that will continue. Wait, what was your first question?
Declaration of Independence.
Yeah. Isn't it wonderful? Isn't it just extraordinary to read the entire Declaration every year on the 4th of July? And I don't know how it started. It started in the mind of one of the producers on the Morning Edition staff long before I joined that program. And his thought was, go around, get all of us on staff to do that. Now, I think this last year, wasn't it more listeners? I can't remember. Oh, you know, I wasn't here on the 4th, so I didn't hear it. I wasn't in the country. I don't know. But there was some talk about maybe turning to listeners instead of the broadcasters to do it. I disagree. I think it's really wonderful to, and he parceled it out So that Nina did the section on the court, you know, and somebody, it was well, and I did something about free communication, something like that. But I find it thrilling, and it makes me weep. It brings me to a full stop every morning when it's on, and it makes me weep through it.
Well, and I think what's also really great is that it's kind of fun to try to guess which, you know, see if you can identify the...
Yeah, who's
the reporters.
Yeah, I think I'm wrong. I think there was just, I hope I'm wrong. I think it was just talk about maybe... I mean, nothing against you, but I think it's rather than do listeners, rather more, I like the idea better of our being able to do it.
There's a hand in the back.
We've all benefited by your thinking out of the box, because I think you've brought some very interesting programming. But was there anything that you brought forward and maybe tried that didn't quite work out, or that you were particularly disappointed it didn't work out?
Oh gosh, I'm sure there was, but I've repressed it. I can't remember for the life of me.
Everything Surely, was a success.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
She's a brilliant genius. That's what it mother.
Is. That's what it is. No, I'm sure. I can't think. You know, we're very lucky because we'll do bad interviews. You know, interviews where our questions aren't any good, or we're off the mark that day, or the guest is not interesting, or unfortunately has a stammer. Although one time I did call someone I wanted to interview, and he said, and I, this is very early in my broadcast career at the local station, said, "Oh, don't worry about it, Mr. Smith. We'll cut out your stammer."
Well, how did that work?
Oh, my God. Anyway, but we're lucky because if it's recorded, you just throw it out. You just don't use it. You know,
live radio, totally different.
Totally different.
Then
you
thing.
Have to fight to make it work.
Yep.
Try to figure it out.
Hope that. Yeah. Go ahead,
Susan. Are we going to hear a regular podcast from you? Maybe a series.
People have been talking to me about doing it, and I don't know. I've been about it. I'm not sure.
Are you going to do a any kind of a program while you're out here?
I didn't line anything. I'm here for fun.
Okay.
And for you guys. I just thought I'm not going to work this one. I'll just go and have a good time. I love Seattle. It gives me a great chance. And I have a lot of friends here who I'm getting to catch up with.
And you are consuming some art here.
Yeah, I've been. I went to SAM, and I went to the Bainbridge Island Museum. Have you all been there? Oh, it's really fabulous, the building. And it's so easy. You just walk off the ferry, and there it is. I really urge you to go over and take a look at it. It's a stunning
and let me
building.
Invite you September 11th, which is the day that we're doing a front row center there. So the artist Barbara Earl Thomas will be with us.
Yes.
And that show is a not-to-be-missed show. It's really amazing. The museum's free if you've never been there. So anyway, if you want to go before then, that shows up through the 2nd. I just finished posting something about this.
Good.
So it's all in my head.
That's going to be
fun.
But
do come on that day. It's a Sunday afternoon.
Hi. Well, I hear that you're not political or wanting to be in politics at this time. I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about the coverage of our election and the media's involvement in that, what your thoughts are. And where do you listen, or where do you go for news?
Well, you know the answer to that one. I go to National Public Radio. I listen to our programs. And daily, I read the New York Times. But now it's so late compared to what we're doing, you know, on the air, that it's just sort of a second reference. And as for coverage, the old stalwarts are doing just fine. What's troubling is that you also, particularly on television, are getting these very slanted channels like Fox, for instance, which hammer over and over again. They make no attempt at journalism or presenting both sides, but they're hammering their side all the time. And so many people are watching them and listening to that it really does skew things. There are not so many places these days that you can go for balance. And it's much harder. Don Gagne was telling me, he's a neighbor of mine, lives across the street, was telling me the other day that this is the toughest election he's ever worked in. He's worked all of them since Abraham Lincoln. He says that it's the toughest he's ever done because he gets on the bus and travels with them. And in the old days, the candidates would come back and talk and hang out with reporters. They do not. That doesn't happen. Those days are over on the Republican and the Democratic side. So you don't get the kind of access you used to for fear that something will slip, something will get out, it'll get reported, and it'll turn against them. So that really, that's an awful thing in a democracy, too, that you don't get the access to the reporters, but it's quite deliberate on the part of the candidates to just protect themselves and keep it quiet. And then the other thing, particularly in the case of Trump, who's such a communicator, you know, he's such a presence, and so many of the things that he says are outrageous, that they are what we would call good tape. Mm. And so they get repeated over and over and over again and drummed in. A more reasonable candidate on the Republican as well as the Democratic side will speak in full sentences, you know, and in a more thoughtful way. It's not as good tape, but it demands attention and it's getting across ideas and plans and calls for action. So that's a real challenge to coverage these days, too.
And also the speed of the 24-hour news cycle.
Oh, good heavens, it's relentless. So you've always got to be filing something, and the scene is changing so quickly. It's tough.
We have time for one more question.
Thank you for your remarks. I wonder if you could share with us what you're doing to mentor the next Susan Stanberg.
Oh, well. I've been sort of doing that for years since I left All Things Considered. Every one of the women, and some men come to me from time to time for a little guidance, but it's mostly the women. And I've worked with all of them. And I'll tell you one story and then we'll stop. It's about Melissa Block. When she and I was with her from the beginning, she began as a booker on All Things Considered. She worked her, as I began as a tape cutter. Melissa absolutely worked her way up to producer, online producer, line producer, and then field reporter and ultimately host. And I've been with her through all of that. And I loved her hosting and I love her presence on the radio. And early I said to her, just one principle or another, and one of mine was, and this is from the 70s, when I interview someone and they begin to cry, I turn off my tape recorder. Because I felt very strongly that it was not my place to earn my living off the misery and suffering of someone else. So that was one of my rules, you know, the Stanberg rules. And I carried it with me to all the people I've mentored over the years. Then she became a host and she went to China and was there during the earthquake. And I don't know if any of you remember her reporting. It was extraordinary. And one of the days she went out in the field with a family that was looking for their child in the rubble of a school that had collapsed. And they were sobbing, and she was sobbing, and we heard it. When she came back, she came to see me, and she said, I broke the rule, you know, I couldn't help myself. I just came over me, and I said, my dear girl, you have raised the bar on reporting to such a new level and a new height. You've done wonderful work, and there's no reason for you to, you couldn't as a human being have reacted in any other way, and it's so wonderful that you were able to do that and let us share that. So that's an example of how things have changed over the years and how you have to rethink your own thoughts and rules on some things and advance the form and advance the work.
Well, I want to thank you, Susan, for setting that bar and then continually raising it for those of us in the field.
Thank you.
And thank you for coming. And thanks, all of you, for coming. We really appreciate you. We can't do what we do without you. So thank you.